Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Last boat out of Shanghai, the Chinese who fled Mao's revolution, by its author, Helen Zia, in conversation with Ben Fong Torres. This program is co-sponsored by the Committee of 100. I am Lillian Nakagawa of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs member-led forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Helen Zia is an award-winning author, journalist, and activist who has covered Asian American communities and social and political movements for decades. Her first book, Asian American Dreams, The Emergence of an American People, was a groundbreaking history of Asian Americans in the United States. She is also co-author with Wen-Ho Lee of My Country Versus Me, which reveals what happened to the Los Alamos scientist who was falsely accused of being a spy for China. Her articles have appeared in numerous publications. Very recently, a piece she wrote called My Mother's Secrets appeared in the New York Times on January 19. She has also appeared in many news programs and films. Her work on the 1980s Asian American landmark civil rights case of anti-Asian violence is documented in the Academy Award-nominated film Who Killed Vincent Chin? Helen grew up in New Jersey, is a graduate of Princeton University's first co-educational class, completed 2 years of medical school, and then went to work as a construction laborer, an auto worker, and a community organizer, after which she discovered her life's work as a writer. Her new book, Last Boat Out of Shanghai, was launched just last week. Its first review, which appeared in the Wall Street Journal 2 weeks ago, was highly favorable. Ben Fong Torres was raised in Oakland's Chinatown, where his parents owned a restaurant. He attended San Francisco State University from 1962 to 1966, majored in radio, TV, and film, and became an editor of the Campus Daily. He began writing for the Rolling Stone magazine in 1968, when it was 4 months old. He stayed at the magazine into the early 80s, compiling more than three dozen cover stories, including Bob Dylan, Marvin Gaye, Linda Ronstadt, The Grateful Dead, Santana, The Rolling Stones, and various Beatles. He was portrayed in the major motion picture Almost Famous, and a documentary about him by Suzanne Jokai is due anytime now. Ben is a longtime radio columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and a DJ and programmer for the online station Moon Alice Radio. He has published 10 books, including a memoir, The Rice Room. Ben has won 4 Emmy Awards as co-host of KTVU's telecast of the San Francisco Chinese New Year Parade. February 23rd will mark his 23rd time as co-anchor. Please join me in welcoming Helen Zia and Ben Fong Torres.
Thank you.
And drive safely. Good night. So Helen and I, you will soon see, have a rapport with each other because we've known each other for many, many years. And all those years, we see each other several times a year at the famous wine tastings. And for the past probably 12 plus years, you would inevitably be collared by a well-meaning friend saying, "Hey, Helen, how's the book coming along?" This is the last thing an author wants to hear. When you're in the middle of research and writing and fighting and debating and arguing with your editor and your publisher and your sources, you don't want to hear somebody say, "Is the book coming out yet? When's going to get a copy?" So you did it. 12 years and well worth the wait. It's a marvelous, magnificent book.
Thank you. Yes.
And to begin with, the very first thing is the title. It's very intriguing. You get the sense of urgency to catch that last boat. And it is out of Shanghai, China's biggest and most sophisticated city. We have our images about it today, but Helen, can you tell us about what Shanghai was like in 1949, 70 years ago, as the communists were approaching and there was panic in the air?
So 1949 marks the start of a whole new era, not just for China, but really for global geopolitics. And Shanghai was the Paris of the Orient. It was equivalent on the level of New York City, London, Paris, Berlin, and that was the, you know, top tier city of the world. And so my book actually begins in 1937, yes, which was the start of the attack by Japan of Shanghai, which was the first city to experience the major battle. And the Battle of Shanghai marked the beginning of what then became the occupation of Shanghai, the war 8 years. So up until that point, Shanghai was just this magnificent city. It was in many ways, I'm just curious, we can't really see, but how many of you have been to Shanghai? I know this is a well-traveled group, quite a few of you.
Yeah.
So many of you are familiar with the world-famous Bund, you know, the beautiful Beaux-Arts granite and marble edifices out there. And it looks like it could be a postcard from Europe and not from China. And in fact, the building of the Bund, they forbid any Chinese architecture on the Bund. So Shanghai was also sort of a bastard city. It was too Western to be Chinese and too Chinese to be Western. And that added to its mystique. It was full of the top intellectuals, not only of China, but the world. You know, George Bernard Shaw visited, W.H. Auden, Charlie Chaplin, Albert Einstein. I mean, really, it was a place of great intellectual activity, capitalism. It was the most industrial city of China and the most modern city. It was also the where the industrial proletariat, the working class, was. So it was the place where the Communist Party of China was founded, and so it was a city of a lot of contrasts, and it had its vices too. It was the center of opium trade, and in fact, that's why there were those international settlements, concessions that were sort of torn from China that made Shanghai into the port city it was. And, you know, that led to the free wheeling and dealing of opium, of prostitution, of gambling houses, and it made Shanghai a very notorious city. And so when the war happened, and that was 8 years, for World War II was 8 years for China. It was the longest, and the country that had to fight World War II for the longest, and mostly on its own, without much help at all. And Shanghai was occupied. It led to really the destitution and the another exodus of people who were loyalists to the resistance, and so there was just a lot that went on leading up to 1949. 8 years of war and occupation, the most beautiful mansions in Shanghai, and there were many, many of them. They all had their metal, their radiators, anything that could be used and melted down were turned into bullets and bombs to use against the Chinese. And so it was a city that was struggling. People were starving to death. If you had any kind of resistance in your neighborhood, the Japanese martial law and occupation would shut down food and supplies into that area. So there were many, many beggars on the street. Children at that time were taught to look the other way if you see a dead body on the street, and there were many. And so that was 8 years of war. The peace, the surrender that came, you know, when Japan lost the war, there was no peace for China, because then the civil war between the nationalists and the communists, the two major contenders then, their civil war just, you know, exploded. So there was no peacetime for then, and Shanghai as a city where all of those points of view were around became a place of terror. I mean, there are books about the terrorism on the streets of Shanghai, where if you were on this side, you know, there were bombs here, bombs in the movie theaters, you know, and so, so you have a population of people, the most sophisticated people of Asia in Shanghai, used to incredible, you know, polyglot city where so many different languages were spoken, and they had lived through war, they had lived through occupation, they had lived through the collapse of one government and their society, where the economy didn't work anymore. People hung in there, and then came the, here comes the Red Army. And for many people, it was the last straw. You know, they had stayed, but this was what was going to happen next. And so 1949 was the panic. And actually it began for some in 1947, 48 was... a year of debate, where families who had money, and there was a large middle class, by the way. It wasn't all the wealthy, you know, the reputation that Shanghai has of, oh, they're all rich. Well, they actually weren't all rich, but there was a large middle class. There was the capitalist, industrial, wealthy class, and all of them were worried. So people who had any kind of business or shop at all, they knew they had had a large Russian population, white Russians, who had that name because they were the losing side of the Soviet revolution, the Bolshevik revolution, and they told stories of what had happened to their families in Russia. So there was this incredible panic, and if you can imagine, you know, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, you know, how all of New York and New Jersey started fleeing because they thought the Martians were coming. Well, that's what it was for Shanghai. And it would be as though San Francisco or New York, New York City, you know, a switch went like this and people were running for the exits and there weren't enough exits. And so people were trampling each other to get to a boat that might take them out. And so that was the mood of a city that was one of the greatest cities of the world and still is. And everybody thought that they were going to be on the last boat. So the title really comes from the sense that people felt that they had to get out or they would lose that chance. So there was the last boat, the last plane, the last train, and every one of them had that sense of panic. And when you speak to people, and I know there are a number of you in this room, too, whose family members would say, oh, my family was on the last boat. And that's what I grew up with. My aunt would say, well, we were on the last boat. And that's all that would be said. And then as I got older, there were many other people who said, well, we were on the last boat. My family was on the last boat, and mine was on the last boat. And you think, wow, that was a really big boat. And then you ask a few more questions, and they all were on at different times, different months, different years. And so, but they all felt that they were on the last one. So that was, 1949 was quite a time. And now we are 70 years later. This is actually the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic.
Well, all of this chaos and craziness involved millions of people, impacted so many people of every generation. And yet, Last Boat Out of Shanghai is a book of personal dramatic stories and of four young people growing up at the time. Yeah, and your stories have a strong sense of place, the capture, the location, and the period. And you have detailed and colorful descriptions of such things as, or people as nuns in a line or dock coolies. And it often reads like a novel. You said one reviewer just reviewed it as if it were a novel.
Yes.
But these are real people. And so I'm wondering if there's one in particular that motivated you.
Well, sure, Ben. This is a history really that spans, you know, approximately 1937 to about the late 50s, early 60s. But it has to be told through people in order to give that feeling of what they went through. And there is one passage I'd like to share with you that probably was the start. And this is, for me, that really got me wondering what else there was. And so this is one of my four characters, a little girl. The four characters are two boys and two girls. The book begins when they are children in 1937, and what it's like to experience war going on around you and your whole world being turned upside down from the eyes of children. And these are people I interviewed when they were all in their 80s, starting 12 years ago. And they had very, very vivid memories of these times. And this is one of them. This is one of the girls. And she was growing up as a child in a small town outside of Shanghai. So Shanghai was surrounded by a province called Jiangsu Province. So this is a little bit beyond Suzhou. And I suspect many of you have been to Suzhou as well. So back then, it was mainly a farming area. And the little girl is in that town with her father. And he was her baba. So Baba announced that he would take Little Sister, as she was known, on a train to Suzhou, 60 miles away toward Shanghai. She remembered every moment of that journey, for she had been giddy that Baba had chosen her, not one of her brothers. She sat on her father's lap, her eyes glued to the window, mesmerized by the neat rice fields and towns just like hers sweeping by in a blur. When they got to Suzhou, they saw men and women dressed in fine silk fabrics and even foreign outfits, unlike her mother and father, who wore a roughly woven traditional dress. Big posters showed pretty ladies with curly black hair wearing tight qipao, promoting cigarettes, mosquito coils, and rat poison. When they left the train station, Baba flagged down the driver of a wooden moon-wheeled cart. After a twisting, bumpy ride over arched stone bridges and canals lined by weeping willows, they finally came to a stop at a small store. Inside, her father spoke to the shopkeepers in a low voice while she stood waiting by the door, looking at the parade of vendors and hawkers on the street. Soon Baba called for her and told her to stand still beside him. The shopkeepers looked into her mouth and squeezed her thin arms. When they were finished poking and prodding her, one of them took her hand and led her toward another room. As she turned to look for her father, she saw his back as he headed toward the door. "Baba, Baba," she shouted after him. He didn't turn around. "Baba, come back," she cried. How could he leave without her? The stranger gently pushed her into a small, dark storeroom and locked the door. Alone and terrified of what might lurk in the darkness, at first she could only whimper. Then she steeled herself and called for her father as hard as she could until she grew hoarse and couldn't shout anymore. Exhausted, she sobbed herself to sleep. When the little girl awakened on the musty dirt floor, she thought she had had a terrible nightmare. But when she tried to open the door, it wouldn't budge. She could see the glare of daylight around the cracks. Once again, she screamed for her father. Baba never came. So this was a story I heard when I was in my 50s. I had already known about this last boat thing, and the teller of this story was in her 70s. She was my mother. And so my mother had never talked about this story ever. In fact, when I was a child, and as a child, I would just say, "Gee, Mom, can't you tell me what life was like in China? Everybody says I should go back to China. What was it like?" And she would say, "Oh, that was wartime. Bad memory." And that would be the end of conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up thinking, well, after a while, I stopped asking. And it wasn't until, you know, I was in my 50s. We were sitting having dinner with my mother, and she, we were just chatting, and I lapsed into my childhood mantra and just said, "Gee, Mom, too bad you can't tell me anything about when you were a kid." And she said, "All right, you want to know? I'll tell you." And so you can imagine, I just stopped everything and held my breath and listened as she poured out this story and many, many more. And at some point, she stopped just to see what my reaction was, and I could only think to blurt out, "Wow, Mom, your memory is so good." You know? What a clever thing to say after a story like this. And she said, I remember everything. I was 6 years old, and it was the worst day of my life. And the thing about it was, you know, I later went on, because this, you know, of course I asked my mother many, many, many more questions after that over a period of years, but I also got very curious about other people, and ended up interviewing over 100 people for their stories too, because this whole last boat, what made that happen? What got my mother from this point to then being on one of those boats? And so this kind of went on, and mm-hmm. that was the impetus for my doing this book.
Was it a matter of with your mom, you can just ask her everything, but with the other major characters, how did you get those details and conversations and dialogue, and especially when they're thinking of themselves from 70 years before, in many cases. How did you determine that when they were saying, well, this is what I said, and this is how that door looked, and then this is what the uncle did when he looked in. You capture it all in, as we said, in almost a novelistic way. How did you go about getting those details from the people as you spoke with them?
Well, I did interview more than 100 people, but while I was doing that, and as the idea of this book started taking shape, I knew I had to find people who did have very sharp memories and vivid sense of what had happened to them, and who could share some of their emotions. Of course, none of them, you know, my mother was one thing. She waited 70 years before she felt safe enough to share this story. And many of the other people, it was the same, I have to say. Everybody I spoke to had the most dramatic, the most sometimes heart-wrenching, and many times, every time actually, the most inspiring stories to tell how they got through these. But I started to narrow down who it might be that I could choose from to become main characters. And then I have to say another quality they had to have was being patient with me, because many of their stories, they didn't just come spilling out. They're like my family. One of my peeps, you know, was a boy whose father was a collaborator. He was a traitor. He was somebody who was a high official under the Japanese occupation, and his job was to find resistance people and do away with them. And so this was his son. And his son had no idea what his father was doing, but his father is an historic figure. You can Google his father. You can find him in textbooks. He was well known for this. And so I knew this about Benny before I started, embarked on this. And I have to say I learned a lot in the process, too. I probably started my first interview with Benny saying, so Benny, your father was, notorious. And how was that for you and your brothers and sisters, especially later under the communists? And I remember Benny's first look on his face. He just sort of looked a little pale when I asked him that, and just swallowed hard and didn't say a lot. And so I realized, okay, this was not the time to ask that question. Benny trusted me, and we got together many times. And, over a 12-year period, there was a lot of questions. I would call him on the phone. I would ask him that. And there came a time when I could ask him, and Benny, what was it like having your father do these things? And you can imagine in 1945, when Japan surrendered, his family had a complete change of fortune. And that's all in this book. But I asked him, what was that like? And he said, well, he was my father. I loved him, but I hated him for what he did to our family, what he did. So it was really a matter of trying to gain people's trust, and I have to give them all my unending gratitude that they did trust me. And you mentioned 12 years.
Yeah.
Well, as you know, as a writer yourself of books and plays, and thank you for taking time away from the musical you're working on right now for this.
I take 12 months to write a book.
Yeah.
I have no problem.
Well,
when you asked me a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago, about my own favorite of the Fab Four of Last Boat, I said Benny, And not just because of his name, by the way.
Okay, Ben, right.
But the ups and downs he went through because of his family, his parents, and the sacrifices that he had to make, and the changes he had to go through, it's just amazing. But he was certainly not alone in going through these adventures and misadventures. Did you have any other favorites among the remaining two?
Well, I can't choose among my people here. But their stories, I mean, their stories are all very different, too. So in asking me how I chose them, I felt that I really needed to have a wide variety, from different social classes, from different economic classes. There was a civil war going on. There was a winning side, the Communist Party, and there was a losing side, the Kuomintang, the nationalist side. And so one of the girls was the daughter of a nationalist official. She spent her entire growing up running away from the Japanese, from people like Benny's father, who were out looking for resistance fighters and their families. And if they had ever been caught, which came close a number of times in occupied Shanghai, they knew that they would be killed mm-hmm. by the officials from Benny's family. But there's also... So I did have a wide range of people, and I... This is about an exodus. When people flee, they are catapulted into the unknown. A lot of the first part of the book is just how much agony there is in deciding, should we go? Should we flee? What is the danger if we stay? What is it if we leave? Where will we go? How will we live? If we can't bring our entire family, who stays behind? And so those were all very tortured decisions. But in that group, there was also some who happened to make it to the United States. And so most of the Chinese who were in the U.S. at that time were here as students, graduate students, professionals. We're not talking about a large number, probably 6 to 10,000 at the time. But when, the revolution happened in China, and really the founding of the People's Republic was October 1st, 1949, but the collapse and the clear collapse of the old regime was when Shanghai was taken in May of 1949. And so when Shanghai fell or was liberated, depending on how you look at it, when that happened, the people who were in the United States were trapped. They got the phrase coined for them being stranded students. They were stuck here. And some of you may know, as on student visas, you can't work. You're here. You're not allowed to take other people's jobs. And so here they were without any money anymore because all their support came from home. And that was done. The revolution was happening, and they were stuck. And one of those people, I thought, because the diaspora goes somewhere, and what kind of life did they face? And we have an incredible refugee and migrant crisis around the world today, and we hear this every day in the news about how terrible these people are. And what we see today of not welcoming migrants and refugees is true every time, everywhere. And in this story, it's where they ended up, and the luckiest ones got to America, but they weren't. They then had a number of challenges being here. And so I just thought I'd share a little bit. First with Ho actually came first to San Francisco, because the major transportation between Shanghai and San Francisco and the United States first came through San Francisco on the American President line. Mm-hmm. And there were two ships in 47 through 49, only two, the General Miggs and General Gordon. So any of the Chinese who came from Shanghai during that period, you'll meet them. That last boat was either the General Miggs or the General Gordon that made it into the U.S. And so Ho came over as a graduate student. He, like the other students at that time, were the cream of the crop of China. They were the very top students who were given a visa and an opportunity to study abroad. And so this is just one thing about Ho is he kept a journal. and he kept every piece of correspondence he had with his family while he was a stranded student. And that went on for years. He gave me those letters. They were in Chinese, and I had them translated into English. And so this is from his journal on that ship. The American ship offered Ho a first glimpse into his upcoming life in America. To cool off from the heat of a sticky August day, he took a shower, his first experience with such a contraption. Nearby was a water fountain, another first. After a few cautious sips, he quenched his thirst from this amazing device that dispensed a continuous stream of clean water, no boiling necessary. In the third-class dining room, he waited in a long but orderly line for servings of sausages, potatoes, carrots, rice, breads, fruits, tea, and sugar, a precious commodity in China. The unlimited quantities stunned him, especially the sugar. That night, he jotted down a new American phrase, "All you can eat." And you can imagine somebody coming from China at that time having that experience. But I wanted to also just continue with a little bit more on what he later found. He came in late 47, spent a year at the University of Michigan trying to get a PhD. The revolution is happening. His future is in doubt here because he no longer has a means of support and he can't get a job. He ends up going to New York. And he gets letters from home constantly about what's going on in China. So, and worried. Every one of these Chinese who were stranded here, they were worried for themselves, but they had no idea what was going on with their families. Overwhelmed with worry for their safety and the staggering guilt he felt over his inability to help them, Ho could focus on little else as he assembled tidbits of information, whatever he and his compatriots could glean from news and letters. If that weren't enough, another disaster came crashing down on him. In July, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service sent him a notice to appear for a hearing. Ho had sent a letter to the INS requesting permission to work part-time. If he failed to go to his hearing, or if he went and said something wrong, he could be deported. If the INS had discovered that he was already working under the table, he could also be deported. What if somebody had turned him in? Had it been a mistake to sue his previous employer under the table for back pay? Ho knew of other students who had been detained by the INS and threatened with FBI interrogations, imprisonment, and deportation. Ho tried to swallow his panic, knowing that his family was being blown around China like leaves in the communist wind. He desperately needed their advice, but he didn't even know where they were. Just thinking about his predicament sent him into a nervous sweat. So this was actually one of the people who was probably better off here because he had worked under the table and did have some money. There were many people who had no idea what was going to happen to them. Mm. So they were all my favorites to your to your question.
Of course.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
And that leads me to circle back to the beginning of our chat, which was about the 12-year process. And a lot of artists and writers being artists of different media, whether they're writing plays or books, will take on other jobs because they can't just... Well, they can't make a living based on an advance, for one thing. But
not if it has to last 12 years,
yeah,
that's for sure.
Attention strays. You need to work and do other projects. I'm guessing that you were pretty straight ahead about this particular 12-year journey. Or were you able to take side trips?
Well, I think you described it quite well. At certain points, you find, well, I really need to get some gig too, like Ho. You think, well, that advance went away for a long time, long time ago, and little things would pop up. But the other thing was that this book also required going to Asia, because the first, the two major points of receiving countries or receiving locations were Hong Kong and Taiwan. You know, Hong Kong was a city that had a porous border. It was a British colony at the time. And up until 1949, Chinese people could freely cross into Hong Kong. And that had been the policy for, you know, nearly 100 years, really, in Hong Kong. But within that year alone, Hong Kong's population more than doubled. It had under 1 million people, and in 1949, it ended up with more than 2 million people, more than half being refugees. Incredible refugee crisis there. And Taiwan was where the losing regime, the old regime, fled to Taiwan. So people who went there, 2 million mainlanders landed on 9 million native Taiwanese people who were already there. And, you know, if you follow U.S.-China relations, the politics in Taiwan are incredibly polarized and dicey, and have been for a long time, depending on whether you were from the side that came from mainland China or the side that identifies more with an independent Taiwan. So I had to go to Taiwan. I had to try to understand what was happening there. And so I was fortunate enough to get a Fulbright fellowship. I lived in Shanghai for 6 months. I went to back and forth, looking up newspapers, documents, archives there. I don't speak Chinese fluently. I speak a little bit of Mandarin, about the level of a four-year-old. Well, actually, after my 6 months in Shanghai, I doubled that. I got to be maybe an eight-year-old. But I can't have an interview in Chinese, but I found people who would help me. Mm-hmm. And so all of that did take a lot, but sometimes I would get sponsored to give lectures in China. So there was a university I went to. They paid my way. That was an opportunity for me to do more research. But exactly what you say, writers and artists, you have to find a way to make it happen. And over a 12-year period, it takes a lot.
About 9 or 10 years into your 12-year journey, here comes Trump.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the stories you're telling about refugees, migration, the difficulties they faced, whether in their old country or the new or would-be new country, became apparently much more vivid to you. Did it actually change courses in your writing, or was it pretty much what you were writing about and addressing anyway?
Well, what attracted me to this to begin with was as a writer and a journalist. I mean, just knowing that there was so much more to this story. You know, I had heard my mother's incredibly heartbreaking stories, and I just knew that that was many more people. So that's what drew me to it first. And, you know, we were in a very different situation politically 10, 8 years ago. And there's no way I could have anticipated that we would be tearing children from their parents' arms and putting them in cages. And so it really did make the terrible, tortuous journeys of these refugees and migrants just more relevant to me as I approached the end. And I just felt that there were so many things that were parallel that we could learn from. And that's the thing about history and trying to make it relevant to people. If we can learn from history and stop repeating it, that's, you know, we would be so much more ahead as a human civilization. And among the things were not only that people went through so much pain to decide whether to flee, and nobody flees and decides to walk 1,000 miles with their babies in their arms or to get onto a rubber raft into the Mediterranean with their, you know, their loved ones. Nobody decides to do that on a whim. And the other piece is just to hear all the terrible, terrible misrepresentations and lies that are said about refugees, migrants, exiles, and how they are all going to basically destroy the fabric of our society. Well, in 1949, that was said about these exiles. That's what's being said today. But if you actually look at any refugee migration, and we have so many to look at, whether it was Jews fleeing Nazi Germany, Vietnamese trying to get on the last helicopter on the roof of the American embassy in Saigon, if they are finally allowed to find a safe haven where they're, you know, they're not planning to rip off another country. They want to go somewhere where their children can grow beyond childhood. And when they find that place, these are going to be the most grateful people who are dedicated to leading a peaceful life. Now, that's not 100%, but it is probably the vast majority. And the other thing of this migration is, you know, one of the things I summarized at the end, which I didn't plan in the beginning, was to look at, well, what happened to this migration? Who ended up coming over with these Shanghainese who fled everywhere they could? Well, in the United States, we're talking about Maya Lin. We're talking about Amy Tan and several Nobelists, including Stephen Chu, who was the Department of Energy Secretary under President Obama. We're talking about Elaine Chao, who is the current Secretary of Transportation, David Henry Huang, you know, and my list goes on and on about the people who are making huge contributions. And so, you know, there's a thing where for Chinese in America or Asians in America, it's that, you know, oh, they're the model minority. They are such an achieving, overachieving group. Actually, it's not. It's that they are the children of immigrants, because 70% of the Asian American population is immigrant. And there are many immigration studies that have shown if you take them over generations, you'll see that the migrating generation and their children, that second generation here, are achieve far more disproportionately than anyone in their peer group. And so that is from wherever they're from. And we're talking about Colin Powell or Edward Dandiket or, you know, and Carlos Santana. That list could go on and on and on about people who have become an important, you know, part of the American fabric. So that's where I ended up partly with this book. I mean, you'll have to read it to see where it all goes. But as we reach this point in history, my hope is that if there's any empathy that or compassion that can be built by these four characters and the other ones that are included here, to also, you know, make the connection to where we are today. Because every, you know, patterns of migration and refugees are pretty similar. The people change, the countries change, but the panic and what drives people to flee and what they face when they land somewhere is pretty similar.
You have convinced me. I'm going to go out and buy a copy right away.
Well, thank you, Ben. I'll sign it for you.
At least I can do. So I had a last question, but I'm going to turn it into just a remark, and that is that your previous books and writings that focused on contemporary issues, especially related to human rights, women's issues, APA topics, this might seem like a departure because the story is centered on China, but in fact, I think you've proven that this was a perfect subject and topic for you to tackle, and you tackled it so well. Congratulations again, Helen.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Thank you so much. Thank you. So I want to thank Ben. I am so grateful for him to take time away from his own writing. And as he said, I mean, it's a battle over time to dedicate yourself to what you're doing, to put yourself in that cave or that cocoon, and then be drawn to this. So I'm so grateful that you did this. So thank you. Ben has a very busy life, and he's going to go into that cocoon right now.
My man cave.
Yes, his man cave. So he is not going to be able to stay with us through the Q&A part that we're going to go to. But I just want to be, you know, just say that you have my heartfelt gratitude. So thank you, Ben.
All right, Helen. And thank you.
Thank you. So what we were going to do is just at this point turn it over to you. We have a mic. Who has the microphone? Oh, back there, this is my lovely wife, Leah. She is a very skilled and incredibly talented person, and she's very good holding a microphone going around, too. So she's going to, if you'll put your hands up, please. Oh, we already have some. I will point out, on this side we have 1, 2, and 3, and then we'll move over to this side, 4, 5, and 6, and we'll start. Oh, Leah, she actually runs everything, too. And but so there was 1, 2, and 3 here. Please speak into the mic.
Okay. I have one question, and it might be hard. Did your grandfather sell your mother, or was he getting her out of the country? I mean, was it a gift to her, or was he selling her? That's my first question. My second question is, were all the people that you interviewed who are subjects in your book, did they all end up in America, or did you get their stories from outside this country?
So thank you for those questions. I had that very same question to ask my mother, which I did not ask the very first time she revealed this story to me. But at some point I did ask her, do you think that there was money involved? And my mother insisted, no, she did not think so. But she was 6 years old. And could she really have known? And I have to say, I suspect there was. She was, you know, and this was sort of the informal, you know, whatever adoption process. There were vast numbers of children who were given away, orphaned, abandoned, not only in China, but in war-torn countries, this is true, boys and girls. And my mother, for as hard as it was for her to experience that, she also said she was very lucky that she did not get sold into a brothel, which could have happened as a girl, or sold into a sweatshop slave factory, which also existed. So the answer to that is I don't know. I have my suspicions, but I actually don't know. I'm sorry, your second question was...
Were all of the people that you interviewed, the other three subjects of your book, did you interview them in America? Did they make it to America, or were they elsewhere?
So I interviewed some of them, one in particular, when they were in Hong Kong. But eventually, so the thing about migration is it's not that people land in one place. Sometimes they find out that, you know, they can't make it there. That's true for migrants and refugees here. They might start as Hmong people who land in Minnesota from the subtropics, and then they go to Fresno, where it's warmer anyway. But so with several, many of the people I interviewed, including these, they ended up somewhere else first. And so I interviewed one in Hong Kong. She is now here because her daughter married somebody in the Bay Area, actually, and she ended up here. So I got to interview her in both places. Of the others, I interviewed most of them here. And because Shanghai was such a cosmopolitan area, people spoke many different languages. And that was one of the advantages to me of choosing Shanghai, too. I met many people who spoke some English, at least. And I did some interviews through translators, but those of you who have ever done that, you know, a lot gets lost in translation, and especially the emotion and the feel. So thank you. And there was another question right there.
It's just 2 days ago I learned about your book, and the title took my breath away because it was, there had long been my family's immigration story. They were on the last ship out of Shanghai, and my sister in Connecticut confirms it was the General Gordon to Hong Kong. And then 3 years later, in New York, I was born, and it took decades for me to realize I was the family American anchor baby because of the risk of deportation. And so I want to thank you for your, you know, dedication to the research and getting this story out. I had to come here sort of like a pilgrimage to the events that without which I wouldn't exist and have the fortune to be an American. What should I ask my sister? From your experience interviewing people, she was 14 at the time. Mm-hmm. What would be the most telling thing I could ask her about what she remembers?
Well, I wouldn't say there would be one question. I'd say there would be lots of questions and whatever she would feel like talking about. Most of the people I interviewed, it took a little while for them to warm up. Some of them, like my mother, had never told anybody before. I would be told the most, you know, stunning stories, and somewhere I would stop them and say, do your children know this? And their children would be adults. You know, they would be my generation. And they would say, no, they're not interested. Or, no, they don't care. And so this is your sister you're talking about. Between parent and child, no matter what the age difference, you know, how adult the child is, there's a lot of stuff, you know. And sometimes a stranger like me asking the questions will just draw out so much more. I've had experiences where I was asking questions and their adult child was sitting in the next room, and they would say to me afterward, I never heard those stories before. I'm so glad that you were here asking these. I wouldn't imagine there would be the same kind of stuff, you know, between parent and child. I mean, I had a gift that my mother gave me. Many parents that I've interviewed, they still haven't told their kids and probably will not ever. Ask your sister and start small. And what was it like? Tell me, what do you remember the most? What was the food like? You know, where did you sleep? You know, what was wartime occupation like? But whatever sparks her imagination. And as far as being an anchor baby, I was too. And so how do I know? I have a dear friend here who's a journalist who encouraged me to file a Freedom of Information Act. Steve here?
No,
not yet. Steve Cheng, who I mention in this book, suggested I file a Freedom of Information Act. It took 2 years before it arrived, and by then I had forgotten that I had done it. But it came as an inch-thick packet of information with my father and my mother's INS hearings, in immigration things, of them to be deported, because so many of the Chinese who were here and stranded, their visas had expired. They had come legally, but their visas expired, which is also true for the vast majority of, quote, undocumented people in the U.S. today. And their visas expired because they had nowhere to go anymore. And this might have been the case with your parents, but so they were stuck here, and they stayed under the radar until they were no longer under the radar. And they had hearings, their paper after paper saying, you're going to be deported, you're going to be deported, you're here illegally. And then the final one said, you're here illegally. You should be deported. However, you have some American citizen children who would suffer, and this is a quote, extremely cruel, unusual hardship if you were deported and separated. And so, therefore, you're not going to be deported. And this is probably what happened to your parents. Now, you have to remember, this is during the McCarthy era. This is during the height of the Cold War, the Korean War. Chinese were suspected of being spies. And even so, there was a heart within the INS, and there was a feeling of a humanitarian spirit. It would have been too extreme and cruel to separate. So what happened, you and I were very fortunate to have been here at that time and not today. So, thank you. There was one more question over here, and then, Leah, if you wouldn't mind going to that side.
Hi, Ellen. Thank you for writing this book. I am on also a personal journey to understand my roots, and my father also fled the Mao Revolution through the Hong Kong side, as you mentioned before. So I'm in the process of writing this book, and I'm interviewing also very similarly my father, his friends, his journey. And I want to touch base on what you talked about in terms of the current political climate against refugee and migrants and immigrants. And I had a really interesting, I had a table discussion with much of my dad's friends. And what surprised me the most was sort of the skip of empathy. I was like, I asked them, I was like, so what do you feel about the refugees now? And there seemed to be an overwhelming sense of my experience as a refugee was not the same as their experience as a refugee. I felt like I had a lot less and they have a little bit more. And so it was interesting for me to discover that there is a sort of the, no matter who the refugees are now, don't feel the same way about the ones that were back then, right? So I wonder if you have any comments on that through your interviews, and especially to those that are in the U.S. now, have been sitting here for a long time, have the voting rights now. Can you speak to that?
Well, thank you very much for that question and the fact that you're embarking on this journey and doing these interviews now. You're starting a lot younger than I was when I, you know, it dawned on me that I should be asking these questions, so that's great. And I think you're pointing to a fact that many people who experience the terrible hardships of you know, whatever hardships may not have the empathy for other people who are going through the same things. And that's why I really do think, you know, the whole thing about storytelling and connecting the way you are with your family and your family's friends. And for every one of us, no matter whether you're from, you know, China and this migration, or from the Caribbean or Africa or Latin America or Europe, you know, whatever roots there are stories. Every family has secrets. Every family has things that somebody is ashamed of that can really reveal the heart and the passion of what is really at the heart of your family. And so those things, I think, are something every one of us can do to help build the bridges to say, well, if this happened to great-great-grandpa, you know, coming from Germany, you know, isn't that awfully similar to what's happening today? And to at least to start that conversation rather than having it just be assumed. Some people's minds may never be changed, but it's the ones that do get changed that really count. And so you're having these conversations. And the other thing I would say is, you know, I also had group interviews sometimes. You can't help it. But you're really going to get the true feelings when you go one-on-one. So because there is a group dynamic too, where maybe there is one person who really feels that, oh, these people don't deserve to be there. But if you talk to the other ones more privately, they just sort of go along with that. So anyway, I would say that as well. And those of you who can read and speak Chinese, the stuff that's going on in WeChat today, which is the equivalent of WhatsApp and, you know, Twitter and whatever, I'm not good at social media. But in Chinese, that's the kind of thing that's being said. Oh, what we went through is so much worse. And it really needs people who can say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're talking about actually the whole history of Chinese in America before the Exclusion Act. You know, the whole entire communities were mostly illegal because they were not allowed to become legal. So for people to dump on, you know, newer immigrants and say, well, we had our papers in order, well, that's actually not true. You know, if you attack today's migrants, you are really attacking the whole history of Chinese in America. So that's a long conversation you can have with your family. But, you know, it really begins with opening up the topic for every one of us. So two. What's that? Oh, all right. I'm getting my instructions. We have time for two more questions, and there were some on this side toward the back.
Thank you very much for your stories. You mentioned the relevance of your book story with present-day American politics. Can you also tell us your thoughts about the relevance of your book to present-day Chinese politics?
Oh, present-day Chinese? You mean U.S.-China politics or China-China politics? So the subtitle of my book is The Epic Story of the Chinese Who Fled Mao's Revolution. Now, when we came up with my subtitle, I must say that I also didn't anticipate, and that might have been naivete on my part, I did not anticipate that the U.S.-China relations would go so far down south as they have been going now. And it's really, you know, pins and needles to find out, like, where is this trade war going? What's that going to do with a global economy, not just U.S. economy? So the relevance of the book is this book really is the story of modern China. It's the story of the birth of a new China in 1949. It begins in 1937 and the events leading up to that. And what is really important to me, what I see in going to China or going here, is just how, you know, we talk about polarization, how much lack of understanding there is on both sides of the Pacific. You know, the vast majority of Americans have no idea even where to find China on a map. If you ask them about Taiwan, they'll say, oh, yes, I like Thai food too. And I've had this experience many times, and all you can say is, what are we going to do about, you know, global understanding with a shrinking globe, a world, and politics? And we know there are going to be two superpowers. Right now there's one, but there is clearly an emerging one, and that's China. And if we have no understanding of China at all in this country, that does not bode well. And on the other side, it is also true. You know, it is a totalitarian country. As much as we know we're being observed by the NSA somewhere, China, everybody is, you know. And so to the extent that those who have relatives, friends, do business there, can have meaningful dialogues and really have person-to-person exchanges, that's really important. And just this book, what people went through, the birth of modern China, and how people are different in China. It's not that everybody's all the same. Understanding that is key. So that's, I think, where this fits in the current geopolitics. There was one more question here that I had said yes to, and this, I understand, is the former vice consul, consul general of the consulate in Shanghai just before it fell in May. We've not had a conversation, but he's here. Thank you very much.
Yes, I arrived on the last Northwest Orient Airline flight into Shanghai. And I joined the American Consulate General, which then was the largest foreign service post in the world. But I was replacing a more senior officer, and the day after I arrived, the General Gordon was parked at the Bund and was taking out most of the American officers, in fact, American business and Chinese, right after I arrived. A month later, I was staying in an apartment house from the eighth floor on my balcony. I watched for 3 days the Battle of Shanghai as the Communist Army drove out the Nationalists. Fortunately, with all the machine gunning going on, the bullets, you know, every 10th one would be a tracer, so we could see if and when it's coming in our direction and duck. But the American officials did not recognize, or the American government did not recognize the communist authorities. Well, guess what? We were in limbo. Half a year before the People's Republic of China. Mm-hmm. And so our American consul general, when he would send messages on official stationery to the local communist theater officials or the mayor or the governor, they would automatically be returned because they didn't recognize the American diplomats. And it took us about a year before we were evacuated because the mouths of the Yangtze had already been mined by by nationalist navy, I guess. We had to go by train up to Tianjin, and fortunately, the General Gordon was there and took us out.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us, and thank you for, you are one of the survivors of that time. I hope, had I known you before, I would certainly have interviewed you, and I think there's a lot of oral histories in a book right there to be told. So unfortunately, that's going to be the last question, and thank you so much for that. I'm so grateful to Lillian Nakagawa and the Asia-Pacific Affairs Committee of the Commonwealth Club, all of you for here, Ben Fong Torres, and I'm being reminded that if you read my book and you are so inclined, please, you know, leave a review or whatever on social media. It really does matter to writers. The publishers really look at this stuff if they want to keep your book in print or not. And so, but I'm so grateful that you're all here, and thank you so much. I'm going to be over there in the back signing books. And so those who didn't have a chance to ask me a question, we can talk back there. So thank you again.
Please.
Thank you.